to the Image Doctors. It's February 1st, 2007. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And we've got another show to you from the snowy confines of Colorado.
Once again.
Where winter doesn't end.
Yep. Not this winter.
We've got a lot of good topics today, and most of them, I'm pleased to say, were suggested by you, our listeners, and we thank you again for that.
Yep, we do like getting suggestions from you.
We love getting suggestions. We really like and appreciate it, because we run out of cool ideas sometimes, so keep feeding us those. So we want to talk about our two main topics today are going to be identifying what good light means, mm-hmm. and dealing with different lighting conditions, and then talking a little bit about the creative process while out on a shoot, things to keep your juices flowing, as suggested to us by one of our listeners. And then we have, our bi-weekly tip. And this week is going to be about choosing a laptop to use in the field.
Right.
Which is also a suggestion from from a listener.
And so, both of us did that within the last year, right?
Within the last 6 months, probably.
Yep. So we'll be talking a little bit about some of the things that we learned in the process and applied to our decision. And I think we're both pretty happy with what we bought.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Laptops have gotten very good lately.
Yep. Okay.
So we want to start off by talking about finding good light.
Right.
And what that means to identify, quote unquote, good light.
Right.
And part of it really depends on what your subject is. Because mm-hmm. different lighting conditions that work great for one subject might not work well for another subject.
Sure. But just stepping back a minute, one of the things that really discriminates a good photo from a bad photo frequently is the light mm-hmm. that's falling on the subject. You can have a fantastic subject. It can be a world-class subject, and if you're photographing it in the wrong kind of light, you're just going to end up with a photo that looks like just a common snapshot, whereas the one that makes someone just go zowie usually comes around by being there at the right time of the day, the right circumstances, and finding that good light.
Yeah, and what I like to do is I take a look at, I'll use landscapes as an example. Mm-hmm. Take a look at a calendar mm-hmm. or a book of landscape pictures, and look at those pictures, the ones that you really go, wow, that's really nice. And then look at the sky and count how many of them are in full midday sun.
Right.
None.
Right.
There's some, not to say that there aren't plenty of shots that have nice blue skies, but then compare that with the ones where you can clearly tell they were shot at late in the afternoon or almost at twilight or very early in the morning.
Right.
Hard to sometimes tell the difference. You know, you can't tell from the picture, but you look and you see those pastel skies and the real soft shadows and
exactly
really
warmer colors.
All of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they were there at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And that quality of light doesn't last particularly long.
No, it can go awfully fast.
Especially depending on where you live.
Right.
Some places are better for that than others.
Right. Now, let's talk a little bit about those situations, and we'll get back to what you were just talking about with geography and weather playing a part in this, too, because it does. So, good light. Well, one of the things that you often hear about is the term golden light, right?
Yeah, the golden hour.
The golden hours and all that kind of stuff, and that's the morning hours, the late afternoon, early evening hours.
It's right after the sun comes up.
Or even
a little before it comes
up.
But when you talk about golden light,
right?
Usually that means we've got the sun in the sky, but it's low in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So the sun has just come up, and that's where you really see, because of the atmospheric conditions, it really creates a yellowish lighting. And here's a case where you wouldn't want to adjust your white balance to neutralize that.
No, the last thing you want to do is take all that stuff out. So that's circumstance where you want to have your white balance set to daylight or even cloudy.
Yeah, and not use it in auto.
Right. Or if you do, just realize you'll probably change it later if you're doing wrong.
Anyhow, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah,
but that nice, warm, late afternoon, early morning light,
mm-hmm.
It can be really nice for portraits
mm-hmm.
because you've got a warming effect. It makes the skin have a glow about it.
Right.
Shadows are long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's because the sun is low in the sky.
Yeah. Now, what I like doing if I'm out shooting landscapes is I like getting to a location about 45 minutes or so before the sun comes up.
Yeah, this time of year, that's cold.
It is cold, especially around here. I think we talked about that in the previous episode.
But you're right. That's the way you do it, because you want to be set up.
And an hour is not bad either. Honestly,
depending on where you have to go,
right?
That's if you know your location,
right?
But because you need to set up, you're using a tripod. You got, and it's going to be a little dark. So,
right. And if you happen to be going to a place that's fairly popular, if you're in a national park or something like that, and the location is well known, you got to get there very early, because otherwise you'll find someone else out in that perfect spot with a great rock in the foreground that you really wanted to shoot. So you got to get out there early. But just in terms of light, you know, ignoring all the other stuff, 45 minutes is pretty good. You get there, you get set up. It takes a little while to get everything configured, especially if you're going to be using filters and a tripod, and you're going to be using a tripod in this situation.
And if you finish setting up a little early, you bring a thermos of coffee, and it's on.
But in some circumstances, you start getting what can be some interesting shots, you know, maybe 20, sometimes even 30 minutes before the sun pops up. They're very different kinds of shots, but I've gotten some very nice ones. And sometimes the camera can pick up things that your eyes aren't necessarily seeing even. So,
especially digital cameras.
Yeah.
You can do some interesting stuff just with a higher ISO or longer exposure.
Right. And you don't have those color shifts and exposure problems that you had with film, where you had to use longer and longer exposure times, disproportionately longer. It was, you know, the reciprocity failure thing, mm-hmm. if you were in dim light. So you don't have that.
What I really like doing in the early morning, or same thing with late afternoon, it just depends, is if you want the sun behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get that real nice sky, and then your subject, whatever that is, maybe it's the mountains, maybe it's not, rocks or whatever it might be, trees, gets lit up
right
with that real nice warm light right when the sun comes up, and it's great.
Right.
And then in the afternoon, you shoot facing to the east a lot of times. So you're not shooting into the sun.
Right.
That's a different thing altogether.
Right. And, you know, quick comment for figuring out times and stuff, sunrise, sunset. There are several different ways that you can go. If you have a GPS receiver, and those aren't all that expensive anymore, and they're handy for marking and finding spots, they'll almost always have sunrise and sunset data on them, both at your current location, and you can put in a location that you're going to as well and get that. But you don't need that. You can also go to most web pages on the internet that have weather data. Mm-hmm. In addition to the forecast, which can be kind of handy to have, it'll also have the sunrise and sunset times for, you know, different cities and stuff, and that'll often get you close to a location, close enough in terms of times. So those are a couple of things I typically use.
Now, we can run into some funny problems is if you've got a mountain range really close by.
Yeah, just realize that that's going to affect you potentially in a couple ways. If your mountain range is opposite from where the sun is coming up, just realize that it's going to start hitting the mountain tops earlier than the projected sunrise. And that can be a very cool effect when you get the alpenglow on the mountaintops, because that's going to be considerably warmer than what you'll see a little bit later, just because it's going through so much atmosphere. And, you know, it can just be absolutely beautiful, but you need to be there early to catch that.
So what other kinds of light? As we said, midday is...
blah.
Is usually the worst, because the light is direct. The sun is directly overhead. The light is very flat. The shadows can be very harsh.
Right.
You get too much contrast. So
the light is very blue, and people don't like that blue light in most photos. It's just not attractive. So, you know, if you're trying to shoot that time of the day, what do you do? Well, you know, one is just accept the fact that you're not going to get any masterpieces potentially that time of day, and settle for snapshots. And, you know, you can do a little bit of fill flash for portraits of people, but they're not probably going to be great.
Take a picture of your sweetheart, make sure you put the fill flash on.
Right. But one of the things that you can do is shift subjects. And one of the things to do is move into the shade and shoot more detailed kind of shots, right? And it could be a close-up of some flowers or just smaller subject areas. So, you know, that's one idea for still being able to continue shooting during the day. The other thing is watch what's happening with the weather. You might have some clouds in the sky, and if you see them starting to head over the sun, then, you know, race to a spot where you can do some of that same kind of shooting. It may not normally be in the shade, but suddenly it's under cloud cover.
Clouds make great diffusers.
They make great diffusers, and now you can start, you know, getting those close-ups of flowers and stuff and get something that's far more attractive looking.
And speaking of flowers and our next lighting condition, mm-hmm. One of the biggest mistakes I see people make when they see wildflowers is they assume that we got to go out on a bright sunny day in the middle of the day to get the most light, take pictures of these flowers, and then the pictures come back. And this was in the print film days, mm-hmm. or even slide film, and they come back and they're not good, and you don't know what's wrong with them. There's just they're too much contrast,
right,
and too much harsh shadows, and there's too much dynamic range.
Right,
the best if you look at close-ups of flowers, most of or small subjects, most of those are shot where you get great saturation is on overcast conditions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so an overcast day, yeah, you don't want to take pictures of the sky if you can avoid it.
No.
But if you go back, again, look at calendars and look at photo books where you see wildflower fields, a lot of times you don't have blue skies, or if they did, it's because the clouds were over the sun,
mm-hmm.
and so it created a very diffuse lighting condition,
right?
That works just really good, because the last thing you want to do is have a picture of an overcast sky. Those never work,
right?
At least in my opinion,
right? Now later in the day, when you get into the afternoon, you start getting into conditions that are just kind of like the opposite sequence of the morning. So the shadows start getting longer, the light starts getting warmer, and you end up with those same kind of situations that were so nice in the morning. The big benefit, of course, is that you're less tired than you were at dawn, but...
Yeah. I wish afternoon shooting worked better here, but...
Yeah, it doesn't work well.
We have a mountain range, a significant range of mountains that is due west.
Yeah, so we've got abusive conditions for...
You just don't get... By the time that you get... That you'd get the golden hour, the sun has already dropped behind the mountains and you're in the shade. You don't get that real nice warm light.
Nope.
It just hurts. But that's... I think that's... when people talk about good light, that's what they mean. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, consider your subject and then consider the time of day.
Right. Now, a couple things that you can do to create your own good light.
Right.
Is
bring your own light to the party, so to speak.
Exactly. Or modify it yourself. And, you know, with the former, using flash can be an option. And, you know, what we're talking about here is not the idea of you're taking a landscape and you just pop a flash on and... go. But it's the idea of modifying the light, sometimes fairly extensively. Now, admittedly, this isn't something I do a whole lot, but I probably should.
You can get away with it if you've got a prominent foreground object.
Yeah.
You can fill flash the foreground and still use the interesting light in the background.
Right, and I've seen some utterly amazing, very cool-looking shots where people used filters over the flash, red filters, orange filters, you name it, and some amazing effects.
For example, one thing that's really interesting that I've seen is if you've got enough flash output, you can shoot completely backlit subjects where the sun is behind them,
mm-hmm.
at that late afternoon or early morning sun, mm-hmm. and then pop the flash, and you can do some really neat effects with that.
Right. And we won't go into depth on it. Maybe we'll talk about it some other time. But, you know, after the sun goes down, light painting.
Yeah, that's another cool one.
Yeah, some amazing photos there, too. That's another thing that's on my list of things
there was
I need to do more.
There was an article by Bob Christ,
uh-huh.
about light painting on Rapa Nui, the island there. Easter Island, I believe, is the mm-hmm. alternative name for that.
Right.
The big stone heads.
Right.
And he went out there and he wrote an article in Outdoor Photographer about doing that.
Yeah.
And I know Dave Black, who we interviewed, mm-hmm. is very much into light painting as sort of an alternative.
Yeah. I really like those kind of photos. It's funny that I don't do them. Again, it's on my list of things that...
Okay, let's write this down. We'll talk about light painting as...
All right.
I've tried it once.
And that'll force us to do it.
And I have tried it. I can honestly say I've seen it done, and I've tried it myself, and it can be pretty cool.
Right.
And it's definitely something that works well with digital cameras. It makes it very doable.
It's very easy to see what you just took a picture of. Change it. And then diffusers are the other thing. We've talked about diffusers in the past. The whole idea is you get something that's circular, collapsible kind of thing that you can take with you in the field. And for situations where you just can't get the good light on flowers or people, diffusers are a way of modifying it.
In fact, if you're shooting, if you're into macro flower work, just somebody with an umbrella or a jacket just to create shade.
Yeah, I've had people stand in certain spots.
Yeah, just to create shade over your subject if your subject is small enough.
Right.
And that can work just fine.
Right.
Well, let's move along. I think we're done, right?
Yep.
Permission to move along, sir?
Yep, permission granted.
Okay. Let's talk about the creative process. This was a long email we got from Dana Lipp.
Great email.
And, yeah, very good email. And he's interested in picking our brains, what little is left of them, as to the creative process. And there's a lot of points in the email, but we're going to pick some of the ones that we thought we could address today.
Very thoughtful email, though.
Very thoughtful.
Yeah.
Dana wants to know what drives us creatively, what kind of subjects we like to shoot, how do we approach them, what is your process, do we revisit the same location to further work out our ideas and refine them. So let's start with those.
Okay. Yeah, and then we'll add on a few other topics after that.
Creative, I don't know about you, but I mean, I get a lot of creative inspiration just from looking at the works of others.
Mm-hmm.
I see good photographs. And me, as being interested in wildlife in particular, I look at a photograph and I go through a couple different levels of what is cool about it or what do I like about it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just the subject.
Right.
What drives me, wow, that's a species of such and such that it only happens here. For example, bald eagles. I know it's a cliche kind of subject here in the United States, but bald eagles are not easy to come by depending on where you live. So I think if I wanted to do the, you know, quintessential bald eagle shoot, what would I have to do?
Right.
I have to go to Alaska is what I have to do, and I haven't done it yet. But that's the kind of thing that really gets me motivated to say, I got to think about this.
Yeah. And for me, I like wildlife, but the thing I enjoy the most is landscape work. And it's probably a different set of things that get me excited. I do like looking at the work of other photographers. I really enjoy that. And sometimes that'll get the thoughts flying about things that I could do in similar circumstances or completely different ones. It gets me thinking. But what really gets me energized is just being out there.
Yes, that was part two.
I love that. And that's my favorite part of photography. You know, we talk a lot about equipment and stuff because that's a popular subject. But honestly, when I think about equipment, it's in the context of using it in
what
those situations. Yeah, what would it be
what
like?
What would I need to get that picture?
Right. So what I truly enjoy, and part of it was what we just talked about, I like being out there 45 minutes before the sun comes up. I like seeing the light change. I like the whole natural environment. I like.
I don't like getting up
no.
2 hours before the sun comes
up.
No,
but
so
you get over that quickly.
Yeah, once
right?
I'm out there, it's okay.
Yeah, I like the sounds that I hear when I'm out there. The quiet, also, you know, just the whole thing. And frankly,
it's only when he doesn't bring me along,
right? So that whole set of things are going on, and I'm just kind of soaking it up. And I find that starts the creative juices, and I start seeing things.
Now, as far as approaching subjects, I mean, it really depends on what you're going to do.
Yeah.
For a landscape, I approach a subject by...
It's easy to stalk a landscape.
Very much so. It's very easy to stalk a landscape, but you do your homework. You find a place, a location that you say, I'm going to go here. And now if it's somewhere local, then yeah, I can go back there. I can have the luxury of saying, okay, I was here at this time today. I did this, but I couldn't see everything. Or, gosh, it would have been better had I done it this way. And so I can come back next tomorrow or next week or whenever it might be and approach it from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I like to go to a place the day before a lot of times and sort of get the lay of the land.
Mm-hmm.
With wildlife, it's not so easy because it's a different approach to it altogether.
Yeah, although you can do that to a certain extent.
If you know where you're going. I mean, if you're going to a wildlife reserve. Mm-hmm. You can be prepared for that. You still got to be there at the right time.
Yeah, and even in places like national parks and stuff, a lot of times the wildlife will tend to congregate in certain areas.
You can ask
more so than others.
Ask the rangers.
The rangers typically know an awful lot.
Those ask the ranger.
They know the behavior patterns, where they're likely to be certain times of the day and certain times of the year. And
for birds, go where there's a feeder set up.
Right.
Because it's, I know that sounds unnatural, but that works. Because you don't have to take pictures of the birds on the bird feeder, but you take pictures of the birds as they're hanging around the feeder, waiting their turn sometimes. Yeah. So that's something I like to do.
And I'm also going to take his question and interpret it in a little bit different way regarding how do you approach a subject. One of the things that I like to do with, you know, landscape stuff is I'll go to a spot, and you've probably seen me doing this before, I know others have, and I'll just set my backpack, that's what I'm usually carrying my stuff, I'll set it down, set my tripod down, and then I'll go wander around for a while.
Yes.
And no camera with me, no tripod with
me. Nothing to burden you.
Nothing to burden me, and I'll just kind of look all around an area, see where the light is coming from, where it's likely to head, watch what's going on with the clouds, you know, is it likely to open up or not, and then I'll try moving around at different heights, you know, getting different subjects in different relationships, different perspectives.
I think that's real important.
It really helps me. I like doing all of that without the camera in front of my eye.
Yeah, I think we have a tendency, and I know we've talked about it before, I'll just bring it back up again, that tendency of always shooting from eye level.
Right.
You know, standing up, whatever that might be, you know, somewhere between 5 and 6 feet off the ground.
Right.
And those pictures, you know, for some subjects, that's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not going to say that's verboten, that you can't do that. But there are so many cool things that you can get by changing your perspective. I like to get low.
Right.
I always like to put my tripod down very low to the ground. Everyone else is around me. And
I like doing that, too. I'll tell you, though, I usually find that I should have gone even lower. That's just one of those things on my list, again, of things to
especially if you're shooting with a really wide-angle lens.
Yeah.
Because you'll get more foreground in, and that helps your image.
Yeah.
So that's what I think, you know.
But that whole wandering around thing and looking at some of the different possible subjects and perspective without the camera really helps me a lot.
Yep. Now, another question that Dana had was, are there things that we do to help us, quote, I'll use the quotes here, see better? And I don't know if I do that, but now I will hearken back to ANPAT 4, fourth ANPAT. Do you remember, because I know you ran the ANPAT, I know that was the first time we actually met in person.
Right.
Before the first night, we all sat down at the YMCA of the Rockies, and JRP came around, I think it was JRP, handed everybody a little plastic empty slide mount, plastic slide mount, on a piece of string so you could wear it around your neck.
Right.
And there was a, on either side of the mount, there were a distance scale written on it for approximating how, okay, the idea here, guys, is I'm talking with my hands here. You take that frame, that empty slide frame, and then you hold that up, and that's more or less the aspect ratio of your film or your digital sensor. That doesn't change. And then you look through it, you know, you squint through it with one eye, and how far away you hold it from your face, from your eye, is going to relate to the angle of view. So the closer you hold it to yourself, the wider the angle of view. It's kind of like using a wide-angle lens.
Right.
And the farther away you hold it as you move your arm away, and if you can see me doing this, I'm gesticulating wildly.
Yeah. But it is a good idea.
But it gets you an idea of like what it might be through the camera.
And that's a great thing to do, you know, when you are wandering around and don't have your camera with you.
So. And I don't even know if I still have mine.
I have mine.
So I might have gotten...
Yeah, I need to use it more often. Because it is a good idea.
But that whole idea, like what Rick was saying, of trying to not use the camera first, I think that's part of seeing. It's seeing the whole picture before you decide to... And then that's going to say what lens you might want to use.
And I think one thing that can help in this general area is also prior to getting to a location and doing a shoot, whether it's the kind of photography we were talking about or maybe travel photography or just something completely different, is just jotting down a short list of things that you would like to photograph. I find that sometimes if I don't do that and think through it, I have a habit of taking certain kinds of pictures without enough variation in them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, good example, if you travel to some interesting destination, I tend to take a lot of architectural shots, places like that. And I have to force myself to remember, well, you could take shots of people who live in the area. You could do close-ups of certain things, family shots, activities you were engaged in. There are a whole bunch of different kinds of things. And it's not a bad idea to make a list of representative types of shots that you might make in an area so that you end up with an interesting mix. Because otherwise there can be a certain sameness mm-hmm. to all your shots. But the whole idea there is that can enable you to see things in your environment that you might not otherwise, because you'll go out looking for them.
Okay, and the last thing we're going to hit on this is Dana's question about, you asked us about how do we integrate the left and the right brain at the same time? Because mm-hmm. you've got the left brain being the creative side, mm-hmm. and that's the idea that says, okay, I'm looking at all the shapes and colors, and
right, and this is exciting, and I like
and
it.
This is cool and
shot, and
very, very interesting. And how can I capture this moment?
Right.
Then you have to interface that with the technical side, your right brain, which mm-hmm. says, okay, I've got to set an f-stop here, and I've got to set exposure, and I got
to figure out what lens to use,
all of that.
Yeah.
And how do you do it? And you had some good ideas on that. I mean, I think.
Well, I think one thing is, you know, we were talking about planning, mm-hmm. and this is the same kind of thing, but maybe on a shorter scale.
This is why you show up 45 minutes before the sun rises.
It can be. But what I always like to do is, before I actually start shooting a subject or a location, I get everything preset and kind of think through, okay, what kind of situations am I going to be in? What is this environment going to be like? For example, if I'm shooting a landscape, then typically I'm going to be shooting around f11, f16, something like that. Why not get the lens set up for that? If I'm going to be doing that, I know I'm going to be shooting on a tripod. Get that set up. If I'm going to be shooting in the early morning light, I know I'll probably be using grad filters or something like that. Get that all set up and ready to go, too. Get everything ready.
Yeah, that way all you have to do is push the button.
Yeah, and then you're simply talking about minor adjustments. And a lot of photographers, too, will drift into certain patterns. And it's not a bad thing, necessarily. It can be a constructive thing. You start recognizing, okay, here's that situation. Here's the pattern. I know how to get everything set up because I've done this before and kind of rehearsed it. So doing some dry runs mm-hmm. at home, if you haven't had a lot of experience in some of these subjects, can be a good thing too. That way you don't get there and fumble and, you know, shoot. Sometimes you only get 30 seconds to get right. The right light. It can be incredibly fleeting.
Yeah, you try to have everything set up in your camera. And, you know, one of the benefits of some of these newer cameras are these shooting banks mm-hmm. where, aside from a few parameters like whether you're an aperture priority or shutter priority, you can have everything else set up so that your ISO is there. You don't have to mess with it. Mm-hmm. Your noise reduction settings, all those things that are in the camera, you can have right. them dialed in the way you want, your tone curve, the,
right.
the color mode. So you're not thinking, oh, geez, I should have been in color mode 3 or whatever it might have been. Mm-hmm. You're already there, and because you have your little landscape shooting bank that you've set up in your right. camera. And I know that I try to do that because I go back and forth between, well, if I'm using a telephoto lens, I need the camera set up one way, mm-hmm. maybe I have the autofocus settings a certain way, but if I'm shooting a landscape, well, that really doesn't matter now, does it?
Yeah, yeah. So, but I think it's essential to do, because otherwise your brain is flooded with too many right. different things.
Yeah, it's hard to switch gears.
Right.
So get everything set up before you get out there so that when the moment
happens,
as much
as possible,
you can just focus on taking photographs.
Yep.
Well, I think if we were to go through the rest of this email, we'd be here for. We'll save some more for next time.
Yeah, because there were
because there's a whole bunch more. We'll, so Dana, we appreciate your
some email great ideas. Enjoyed talking about them.
So that brings us to the our biweekly tip, mm-hmm. Our photo tip, or something, bad ideas of ways to spend your money from Jason. But we had an email a while back, a good question about from a listener who's getting ready to buy a new laptop. What should you look for?
There's if you're going to be using it a lot
for photography.
For photography.
So what we assume and the way we use our laptops is, I know that we're very similar in the way that, not only the way we shoot, but the way we have our computer set up.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you use that Windows thing and I use the cool computer.
The one that likes to pretend to be cool.
Hey, I've seen the commercials. I know what's cool. Come talk to me after you've upgraded to Vista. But anyhow, we both use a desktop computer as our primary machine, mm-hmm. for doing all the hardcore everything. That's
right.
Where the major post-processing happens. So our laptops are an extra, it's a luxury, I know, of having an extra computer so that we're on the road traveling, we've got somewhere to download our cards into, and sure, maybe send some email or do some basic post-processing, because you always, hey, in digital photography, you love to look at your pictures every night.
Because you can,
so you just
right.
do it. So if you're going to have a computer that is a reasonably good performer for doing that kind of work, whether it's a PC or a Mac, mm-hmm. there's a few things that we've identified as being pretty important.
Yeah.
And the first of that is hard drive capacity.
Right.
If you're buying a new laptop, I would say nothing under 100 gigabytes
right.
for a hard drive.
Right.
And there's a couple of reasons for that. Obviously, reason number one is storage space.
Mm-hmm.
But reason number two, and the often overlooked reason, is your computers these days make a lot of temporary files that you don't even know about. And so if you've got a hard drive that is nearly full to capacity, performance will begin to degrade, because things like virtual memory and all these things that the computer mm-hmm. uses, the operating system will use the hard drive for that.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be able to store all those temp files, even if you're not doing hardcore image processing. So if your hard drive is more than 90% full, you're going to see some issues potentially crop up with that.
Yeah, and hard drives are not that expensive. Bumping up the drive and capacity a bit really doesn't cost you that much more. It's absolutely worth it.
And when you're configuring a laptop, let's face it, you don't have a second bay.
Right.
Upgrading your hard drive in a laptop is not the easiest thing to mm-hmm. do in the world. So buy the bigger one first.
Right.
I know mine right now, the one that I recently purchased, is a 120 gigabyte mm-hmm. capacity.
Yeah. And I think mine is 100.
Now, if you're really hardcore serious, the other thing you could look at is would be getting upgrading your hard drive to be one of the 7200 RPM models,
because mm-hmm.
that will give you a performance boost. But with the new SATA internal laptop drives, even the 5400 RPM ones are pretty good performers.
Yeah.
They're just, the faster the hard drive spin, the more quickly the data can be accessed.
Yeah.
So that's one. Number two, how much RAM should you get?
Well, after having a fair amount of experience with varying memory locations and current applications, I have to say I would recommend get 2 gig.
Yeah, at least.
Yeah.
I mean,
but two will work pretty well.
Mm-hmm. That's what I have.
Yeah.
And that's what you have.
Mm-hmm.
I think my computer can be upgraded to 3.
Right.
If I want to spend a small fortune on doing it, because
mm-hmm.
those memory modules get expensive. But 2 gigabytes is really, I agree, that's the minimum.
Yeah, at least with the applications that are around right now and in the foreseeable future, you know, near future, I think it's the sweet spot. There are several of them out there that tend to start choking off when you get down to a gig.
And it sounds silly, doesn't it? But that's just how it's gone.
But it is a fact, and it's especially true if you're going to have more than just one imaging application up. And that's not an uncommon situation by any means. You could have a RAW converter up, and you could be converting them and then popping them up into Photoshop. And those could be separate applications. You could have other things running. So 2 gig, I think, is the sweet spot.
I would agree. So make sure your laptop comes with that. And if you're really looking, you know, forward thinking, if it can hold more than 2 gig so that you can upgrade it in the future. Memory is fairly easy to upgrade mm-hmm. compared to things like hard drives
right.
and processors. So if the laptop has the option, if you have one that maxes out at 2 gigs versus one that maxes out at 3 or 4 or whatever, get the one that has the higher capacity, mm-hmm. even if you don't buy more than 2 gigs when you first mm-hmm. buy your laptop. As far as processors go, I think we both agree that they're all pretty good right now.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want to buy the lowest end processor.
Yeah. But most of them are going to be pretty decent. I think the memory is going to be the more important thing for this kind of work.
A lot of the laptops now all have the Intel, you know, the Intel Core 2 Duo seems to be the
right
choice, and that's really nice. Mine has that.
Mine too.
And the dual core means you're effectively getting a dual processor machine, mm-hmm. and that is great because that's something that wasn't in laptops up until fairly recently, and it used to be laptops always perform a little slower than their desktop counterparts, partly because of power issues were driving them to use lower clock speeds and slower processors. So these Core Duo dual core chips are great,
yeah.
I think. Make sure, and this is probably a no-brainer, but make sure you've got at least one USB 2.
And I think it would be hard to get a laptop that didn't have...
Make sure you've got USB 2 or even a FireWire, because that's going to allow you to do some fun things. If you're really thinking about adding, say, an external hard drive...
Which is a good idea.
Which is a thing you might want to consider, then FireWire may be... You can get them in USB 2 or FireWire enclosures.
Right.
And those, FireWire, I think, is a little bit better for but both work just
fine. Both work fine. I've got an external hard drive for my computer. I think, if I remember correctly, it's a 100 gig drive also. It hooks up on a USB 2.0 port. And so what I actually do, I think I talked about this in the past, is when I download my images to my laptop off of a card, I use Photo Mechanic, and it will actually write to both my internal hard drive and my external hard drive at the same time. And so
yeah, that's a great feature.
Got it backed up, and I'm ready to go.
You just don't want to find yourself in a position where you don't have a lot of USB ports, and most of the laptops now have at least 2, if not 4, mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, because you might be plugging in a card reader, and you want to have that plugged in at the same time as you have your external hard drive plugged in. So all of those
and
things.
A mouse.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the last thing to look at it would be the display.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the display turns into, form factor, kind of the size and shape of your laptop will be dictated by the display. And we kind of like the 15-inch widescreens, 15.4, 15.2, whatever they might be, the wide aspect ratio. That seems to be good for a couple of reasons. The widescreen is just nice,
right.
But it lets you have palettes open and still have your image. It's also more in line with the aspect ratio of the pictures you'll be looking at.
Right.
So it's just kind of nicer than the square aspect ratio. I don't recommend going any larger than that simply because, for me, that's cumbersome in the field.
Right.
I mean, the 17-inch laptops are really intended to be a desktop computer that I can take places if I want to.
Right.
Versus a true portable computer.
Yeah, the 15-inch are, I think, the sweet spot for that. You can still carry them around, but they give you a big enough image where you can work on stuff at night and have no problem. And resolution is very good on a lot of them. Mm-hmm. I think mine runs around 1600 by something or other.
Crazy.
And that works great, you know, when I'm using things like Photoshop, et cetera.
Right. Other little things, I mean, most of them now come standard with things like CD, DVD burners.
Mm-hmm.
A DVD burner would be a great thing
Absolutely.
On a laptop. Although, depending on how you're going to implement that, I usually do most of my burning when I'm back home at the ranch. But, you know, because how many of us want to bring a spindle of DVDs?
But it's a good option to have.
But if you were somewhere where you're going to be on an extended period of time, or maybe not in rustic conditions where you could go out to your local, you know, store and get some DVDs, mm-hmm. that's not a bad thing. So that's what we think. Anything else you can come up with off the top of your head? I think that's sort of the basic stuff.
No. I think a higher capacity battery can be a good thing.
Or a second battery.
Yeah, or a second battery.
I got a second battery.
Be worthwhile considering. It can help if you're out for a long time, or you end up working on images on a plane, or just, you know, a bunch of different things, especially longer flights.
Or if you sit in the fancy seating, you could get an airline power adapter.
Theoretically, I've never gotten one of those in the fancy seats. So I don't know. Maybe they've hidden them from me.
Yeah, some of them they claim to have power. I don't know. I don't travel enough.
Yeah.
Well, that's our show.
I travel too much. So.
You travel way too much. Anyway, as they say, well, that's our show for today, folks.
Yep.
We hope you've enjoyed this wonderful episode of The Image Doctors, because we know it's just our best episode ever. Just like. But we really do appreciate getting the emails. So please contact us at talkradio@nikonians.org. That is our email address. We get them. We check them regularly.
Yeah, and we haven't forgotten about the R1C1 review.
Stops snowing here,
God.
We would.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
We're gonna try. We're gonna try, because we'll tell you. It's really good.
Yeah, it's a combination of stopping snowing and me not having to go out of town.
Yeah, so, we're out of the country.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the way it worked recently.
Okay.
Several times. Okay.
Well, until next time, we are the Image Doctors wishing you happy shooting. See you in 2 weeks.
All right, bye-bye.